today, hostage diplomacy, how an unpaid debt by Britain helps to explain Nazanin Zaghari-Ratcliffe's imprisonment in Iran and the fact that she is now facing more charges. Nazanin Zaghari-Ratcliffe probably wishes that we didn't all recognise her name. She was snatched in Iran in 2016, convicted on spurious charges and jailed for 5 years. Even after being released on house arrest because of the COVID pandemic, prison guards would accompany her everywhere, even emergency medical appointments.
So even when she went to the doctors, there'd be a Revolutionary Guard guy in there sitting, watching her being examined. You know, when they saw the gynaecologist, the agreement was that he would sit behind a curtain.
When she was seeing a gynaecologist, she had a prison guard sitting behind a curtain?
Absolutely, absolutely.
But for Nazanin's husband, Richard Ratcliffe, there was something to hold on to. The prospect of his wife being released last weekend when her sentence ended.
So on Saturday afternoon, when I spoke to her and the ankle tag had just come off, she was euphoric. Just able to go and visit her grandmother, visit friends. She went to visit the families of some of the other British citizens who were being held. And she's not been able to do that for 5 years. So big grin on her face, big grin on her mum's face, big grin on her dad's face. And they called me up and said congratulations. So really feeling like it was all over.
But it wasn't all over. Because after Nazanin was released, she was told she couldn't leave Iran. And worse, she would now face fresh charges in a court case this Sunday, in a blow for Richard, but also for the couple's six-year-old daughter, Gabriella.
You know, obviously we did a countdown with her that ended on Monday for Mummy to come home, and Mummy didn't come home.
For Richard, the continuation of his family's nightmare is not a surprise, because he believes that the decision to detain his wife has never been about her or the trumped-up charges against her, but about tensions between Britain and Iran that date back to the 1970s and that are centred around an unpaid debt worth hundreds of millions of pounds.
Nazanin was essentially a percussion instrument for the Iranian Revolutionary Guard to signal their displeasure over the settlement of this debt.
This week, Boris Johnson intervened by ringing the Iranian president to demand Nazanin's release. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, when will Nazanin Zaghari-Ratcliffe be free to return to her husband and daughter? Before we start, I want to warn you that we discuss suicidal thoughts in this episode. Patrick Winter, you're The Guardian's diplomatic editor, and you've reported extensively on Iran. This is a devastating human story. We've all followed the tragedy for Nazanin and her family. But as the years went by, her husband Richard came to realise that this wasn't really about Nazanin and ludicrous claims that she was a spy, but about tensions between the UK and Iran that date back to before she was even born. Tell me what happened.
Well, I think to understand this, you really have to go back to the 1970s and the fact that the UK had sold chieftain tanks to the Shah of Iran, who's effectively their king and had been so for many decades, and with whom the UK have very close relations.
Her Majesty, the Duke, Princess Margaret and others of the royal family welcome the Shah of Persia, arriving in London to begin a 3-day state visit. The courageous Middle Eastern ruler was a most welcome guest.
The UK had very close relationships with the Shah and were his main arms sales source. And these were huge arms deals. But when the Shah fell...
In January 1979, massive demonstrations and crippling strikes forced the Shah and his family to flee Iran.
Khomeini, almost unknown outside of Iran just a few months ago, returned a hero, the man who from long distance had led the revolution to topple the Shah.
Ayatollah Khomeini returns to a country teetering on the brink of civil war.
To the horror of the Foreign Office, there was a decision by the UK to terminate the arms contract. But the Iranians had paid up front for this and they wanted their money back.
Why did the fall of the Shah in 1979 mean that Britain couldn't deliver the tanks?
The Foreign Office discovered what they regarded as a theocratic, revolutionary Islamic regime had taken over, and they did not want to sell any arms to an organisation such as the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps.
And I know the question of the debt has been in and out of court over the decades. What has the UK argued about why it shouldn't pay?
Well, there's been a variety of reasons. One was just trying to prevent the belief that they owed them any money at all. Then there was an argument about at what level should interest be set and for how long. Thirdly, there was a sort of reluctance in the Foreign Office to give any money to Iran, given its politics and where it stood in the Middle East. And finally, there was this issue of sanctions have been applied both by the European Union and America that made it very difficult for the UK simply to give the money to the Iranian Ministry of Defence without falling foul of American sanctions.
And if we fast forward to 2016, where this all begins, really, what were relations between the two countries like then?
Well, they've always been very rocky. There's the Iranians have two sort of great enemies in the world, one of which is America, the great Satan, and the other is Britain, the sort of mini Satan. But actually, at that point, just before 2016, there had been a thaw in relations between the West and Iran.
Today, after 2 years of negotiations, the United States, together with our international partners, has achieved something that decades of animosity has not: a comprehensive, long-term deal with Iran that will prevent it from obtaining a nuclear weapon.
The nuclear deal had been signed in 2015, and this set the terms on which Iran's nuclear activities could be monitored by the UN. All its sites could be watched.
This deal meets every single one of the bottom lines that we established when we achieved a framework earlier this spring. Every pathway to a nuclear weapon is cut off.
So in a sense, there was the relationship was on an upward curve. But within Iran, there are many centers of power, and there were many people who were not happy with the deal. They thought it was a sellout, and they also were wary of there being closer relations, both economic and cultural, between Iran and the West. And what you start to see around 2015, 2016 is quite a large number of Europeans, Americans, being picked up by the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps.
Well, good morning, Robin. The conviction of the Washington Post reporter resigned as a U.S. spy is being denounced this morning by his editors as an outrageous injustice.
Iran's detention of a number of dual nationals continues to place a strain on relations between it and EU member states.
I think British Iranians are definitely feeling the strain of tensions. And this stems from the fact that the Iranian government has been detaining a number of British-Iranian dual nationals inside the country.
Wow, so pretty complicated. The Iranian government doing deals, but the IRGC, who are a hugely powerful military-like organisation, almost a state within a state, defending the country's Islamic system, wanting more distance from the West. And on top of that, the debt in the background that you've told me about. That's the context when Nazanin entered this story. Tell me about her. What was going on in her life back then?
She'd come to London where she was studying, and she'd met Richard Ratcliffe.
We met at a student conference. Went for coffee, then went for another coffee, then went for another coffee, and fairly early on just really clicked. So we started dating probably officially a month or so after we first met. And then we got married in the summer of 2009.
And she then got a succession of jobs, either helping train journalists outside Iran in other countries, or she'd been working particularly for the Thomson Reuters Foundation.
And then we lived in London, and Gabriella was born in 2014, so we've been married for 5 years by the time she came along.
And I think she was two at the time, almost two, when Nazanin took her to see her parents in Tehran in April 2016.
So it was there for Nowruz. Nowruz is, it's like being there at Christmas. So it was 2 weeks. And I think she saw lots of relatives and that sort of wider extended family, caught up with people she hadn't seen for a while.
And what happened on the 2nd of April 2016?
Nazanin was leaving with a suitcase and with a trolley of presents she was taking back to London when she was, to her surprise, and you could see the sense of shock on her face, stopped just at the customs.
But they were clearly waiting for her at the check-in desk. Taken off, so there was a passport problem, come aside for a couple of minutes questions. Had a few minutes questions with Gabriella, and then Gabriella got taken back to give to her granny, who was there to see them off. And then said, Nazanin said to her, listen, it's going to be, said it'll take about an hour or so, so don't wait, or take a couple of hours, don't wait at the airport, go back home and I'll be in touch.
And you can see she becomes more and more worried to the extent of panic struck about what is happening and why she's being detained.
And then she just disappeared. After 24 hours, they tried to go back to the airport to find out where she was. And her dad went back and was there for a few hours. And no one would say anything. And I think no one dared say anything. I didn't understand. Like, I didn't, there was a delayed, I mean, it's not to my credit, but it took me quite a long time to get what was going on.
It sounds terrifying. When did the family first hear from her?
I think there was a call to say that she was alive, but she wasn't allowed to give much detail about what had happened. And again, this is very typical of what the IRGC do, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps do when they pick up these dual nationals.
What was she charged with?
Well, she was initially not charged with anything. There was a very long period of interrogation, but it then became clear she was going to be charged with some aspect of breaching Iranian national security and that she had tried to undermine the Iranian state. You often have these very, very broad charges that are brought in front of the Iranian Revolutionary Court. And one of the difficulties is it's very difficult to disprove them because they're so broad and there's nothing very specific within them.
When was the trial scheduled for and what happened?
It did not come to trial until September 2016. And I think she was able to ring her parents and to say what had happened afterwards, that she'd been sentenced to 5 years for sort of spying related charges, which she regarded as a kind of total misconception of what she'd been doing for Thomson Reuters and previously for the BBC.
So, Richard, no access to the trial and a phone call saying your wife had been sentenced to 5 years in prison. How did you react?
Confess, I didn't believe it. Like, I was like, well, what's happened here? Like, but what's the crime? Like, you can't just convict someone without saying what you've convicted them for. And I remember asking, well, but what for? And she said, no, it's for 5 years. No, but what for? And it came out, oh, it's national security charges. That's all they would say. And I remember being bewildered by it. I think for me, it still all felt like some sort of crazy parallel world, Kafkaesque world. I didn't feel it was real. I mean, it never occurred to me back then that it would actually be a 5-year sentence. It just felt like it was made up gameplay.
Do we know what her conditions were like? Whether she was mistreated?
She was mistreated in the sense she was taken away to a prison north of Tehran and she suffered two periods of extensive solitary confinement in a very tiny cell, windowless, airless, and with no contact with the outside world. At one point during the solitary confinement, she was manacled to her bed and told that she would not be receiving any visitors. And I you just cannot imagine how frightening an experience like that is. It's a form of what they describe as white terror. Richard found out quite early on what had happened. And the issue for him, which has often been the case with families of captured dual nationals, is do you go public and explain what's happened, or do you rely on the kind of private diplomacy that the diplomatic service in the UK and elsewhere tend to favour?
The advice is not consistent, actually. So if you talk to a sort of a lawyer that deals with hostage cases, they'll tell you to keep quiet.
And I think Richard quite early on decided that was not going to be a course he would take, and he would campaign in public and say what had happened. I think the great dilemma for Richard Ratcliffe was always, having made that decision to campaign in public, was it the right decision?
It's been almost 5 years since you made that decision to go public. Are you glad you did?
Yes, I'm glad I made that decision. It probably was not as tortured for me as it was for others. I think when I made the decision, it was very tough for my in-laws. And probably being British rather than being Iranian British, I was just struck by how crazy the whole thing was. And my instinct was, well, you know, if you want to correct injustice, then, you know, speak out about it. Have I ever regretted going public? No. I'm probably not in an honest place to answer it. And it's only afterwards when you could really reflect on what went well and what didn't go well. But I'm absolutely sure that us being very public about Nazneen protected her hugely. You know, Nazneen was spared the worst of what some hostages have been through.
So, Patrick, we knew Britain still owed around £400 million. And it was being argued over in court. And we knew that Nazneen had been taken and was serving a 5-year sentence. At that point, had the two things been linked?
I mean, Nazneen Zaghari Ratcliffe herself has said that some of the judicial figures, court officers, said to her explicitly that her arrest and her detention is linked to the debt. I don't think there's any doubt in anyone's mind that it forms a huge part of the backdrop of her case and those of other British Iranian dual nationals that have been arrested. The way in which this issue is dealt with is both the Iranian officials I've spoken to and the Foreign Office say there is no formal linkage between the issue. But I think if you speak to some Iranian officials privately, they would use phrases like it's part of the climate that is around this case and it's part of the backdrop. But neither side wants to be owning up to the fact that there is what in effect is a form of hostage diplomacy.
Richard, Patrick used the phrase hostage diplomacy. Now, I've noticed that the government doesn't use language like that. But there are no legitimate charges against her. So isn't hostage the right word?
So yes is the short answer. I think she always has been a hostage. I think it took us a bit of time to realise it. And it took us a bit of time to say it. It felt a very heavy word and a brave word. I think it took me a while to realise that I would have to use the word first before anyone else would. I think it probably took another 6 months before government ministers were willing to acknowledge it privately.
Patrick, this was a frantic time in British politics. It was 2016, it was the EU referendum, David Cameron resigned. There was a kind of vicious race for the Conservative leadership. And at the end of it, Theresa May was Prime Minister and her Foreign Secretary was Boris Johnson. And I will never forget watching him intervene disastrously at the Foreign Affairs Select Committee when it came to Nazneen.
When you look at what Nazneen Zaghari Ratcliffe was doing, it's just, you know, she was simply teaching people journalism, as I understand it.
What he meant to say, that was in the Iranian viewpoint, that she was training journalists. He wasn't supposed to be endorsing that she had been. But the Iranians were really quick to capitalise on the remarks as proof that what they'd been saying all along was true. And he had really blundered.
How did you feel when Boris Johnson made those comments to the Select Committee?
So at the time, that was the first time any government minister, any government senior official had criticised the Iranian treatment of Nazneen. That was the thing we heard first. I noticed the mistake, but that wasn't the bit I reacted to first. as the Iranians picked it up and, you know, it changed her court hearing and it then became a big part of a fairly relentless propaganda stream that they put out of, you know, victim blaming. And then we were ending up on the front pages day after day. And I remember at the end of the first week, it was Michael Gove was sent out onto the airwaves on the Andrew Marr Show and others. Iranian
prison. What was she doing when she went to Iran? I don't know. One of the things
to muddy the waters, essentially, and to sort of claim that it wasn't clear what Nazanin was doing and that Boris hadn't made a mistake.
Yes, I think Boris is doing a great job as Foreign Secretary. I also think that the attempt to shift the blame away from Iran and onto a democratically
elected
tradition.
I'm not trying to shift the blame away
from Iran.
I thought, gosh, you know, I'm so out of my depth here.
In the end, he semi-apologised to the Commons subsequently.
The British government has no doubt that Mrs. Zaghari Ratcliffe was in Iran on holiday, and that was the sole purpose
saying,
of her visit.
He should have been clearer in his remarks, but that they'd been misinterpreted deliberately by the Iranians.
And I acknowledge that the words I used were open to being misinterpreted, and I apologise. I apologise to Mrs. Zaghari Ratcliffe and her family if I have inadvertently...
Anyway, it led to a real problem for him because the Iranians were on the warpath and they felt that Boris Johnson had handed them some golden ammunition.
And there was more. A story leaked to the Sun newspaper suddenly and for the first time publicly linked the sentence to that £400 million debt that Iran was demanding. But while it was becoming increasingly clear that this wasn't about one person, but this much bigger tension between two countries, Nazanin was still in jail. How was she coping?
She was in Evin prison, I think in the women's section, with maybe five or six other prisoners, mainly what were called security prisoners, political prisoners, both Iranians and dual nationals. And I think she said she was struggling a great deal. She both had physical pain and she was suffering mentally. And I think she has admitted and said many times that she had suicidal thoughts.
The hardest phone call for me, she was very cold and distant. That was the one that scared me. I think being on the phone when she just cries a lot, and not being able to do anything about it is hard.
And I guess my next question then is, if we owed Iran money at this point, why didn't we pay it? Johnson even went to Tehran, didn't he? And there was great excitement about that trip, but then nothing.
Yes, Boris Johnson went to Tehran and so did the his successor, Jeremy Hunt.
Thank you very much.
And I think the difficulty is, I went with Jeremy Hunt to Tehran on that visit, and the difficulty is that you are not really speaking to the relevant people. You can speak to the foreign ministry and to the foreign minister, Javad Zarif, and I think Jeremy Hunt would tell you that I don't think he believed for one minute that Zarif thought Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe was guilty, but that the decision was not in his hands. So I think they knew all along that the money was the issue, but they just struggled to find a way to pay it.
And you say pressure from the Americans, but didn't the Americans pay around money in the same period?
The Americans did, under John Kerry, when he was Secretary of State, pay quite a lot of money to get people released.
For much of the 18 months I was in prison, my Iranian interrogators told me that the Washington Post did not exist, that no one knew of my plight, and the United States government would not lift a finger for my release. Today I'm here in this room with the very people who helped prove the Iranians wrong in so many ways.
John Kerry was Secretary of State under Barack Obama, and I think that if you look in detail about the way in which America deals with its hostages, it's quite willing to do deals, and indeed they have a special envoy for hostages whose job is to do those deals.
I find it amazing that a country has an envoy to deal with hostage taking in this way. How common is it for states to arrest people and jail them because of other geopolitical matters?
It's increasingly common, and I think it's one of the things that needs to be stamped out. And I think what Iran is the kind of prime example of it. You might say it's a function of their weakness that they feel it's necessary to do this. But you look around the geopolitical chessboard and Iran is picking up people from France, Germany, you know, 66-year-old architects, academics, people from Austria, from Belgium, from Australia, and all the while they'll be seeking deals in return for handing them back.
And whilst Britain has been quite purist about it, how have other countries dealt with Iran?
Well, you can look at the case of Kylie Moore Gilbert.
Australian academic Kylie Moore Gilbert says she was psychologically tortured.
Where she was released, and at the same time, two Iranian so-called diplomats were released in from Southeast Asia, where they had been accused of trying to assassinate an Israeli diplomat. And it was absolutely clear that, because they happened within 24 hours of one another, that these two cases were linked.
The Australian government never confirmed, but Iranian media reported her release was part of a prisoner exchange deal of three men involved in a bomb plot targeting Israeli diplomats.
So Australia clearly did a deal with Iran.
The UK is an outlier in its record of getting people home. Like, it's the worst. I do think there's a fundamental problem in how the UK approaches hostage diplomacy. So it's hostage policy where governments are taking hostages, which is woeful and is premised on you know, keeping, downplaying the abuse, downplaying the emotional tension, the political tension, and looking for a diplomatic solution. That's a perfectly standard diplomatic approach, but we're effectively talking about a form of organised crime. If it was any other form of organised crime, you wouldn't just wait for the criminals to get bored. You'd be a lot more interventionist.
Coming up, Nazanin reaches the end of her sentence, only for the nightmare to continue. Patrick, prison was clearly hellish for Nazanin, and in 2019 they even changed the rules and reduced her contact with family. Her daughter Gabriella returned to her father in the UK.
So everyone, this is Gabriella.
Yeah.
Seeing her sleeping last night, and you know, strange sounds she was making, and she's much bigger. I mean, she went out 1 3/4, and there she is now. 5, got her own view, thank you very much. And yeah, it's lovely. Bless her, she's been very brave. And yeah, we'll take it one day at a time at this point.
Although by then there was a real language barrier and she had to learn English. And then COVID-19 hit Iran badly and many prisoners were released, including Nazanin, to her parents' home, where she was under house arrest with a 300-metre limit. Like so many, I saw the breaking news alert about her being freed last weekend and I looked at my phone. It was very exciting. But quickly it became clear this wasn't the full story. What happened?
Well, her 5-year sentence was coming to an end last Sunday. There was no way in which she should be legally kept in jail beyond there. And the expectation amongst Richard Radcliffe and the family was actually nothing was going to happen. She would still be kept on a tag and the basically be status quo. But the Iranians decided that the 5 years was up and therefore to remain compliant with at least with Iranian law, the tag should be taken off. But it was a really bittersweet moment because there had been hanging around the possibility of second charges. They'd been mentioned in 2017 and again last year. And what they did was to say that she would be back in court this coming Sunday, where they issue the second charges. Now, not absolutely clear in what context they'll be raised in the court, but it means that she's now free to travel wherever she wants in Tehran, but she has no passport, can't come back to London. And there is the horrific possibility that she could be found guilty and put in jail again for another 5 years.
And what is it exactly they're accusing her of now?
in a sense, it's very similar. It's propaganda against the regime. Two of the pieces of evidence being cited are that she attended a protest outside the Iranian embassy in London, and that she spoke to a reporter from BBC Persian, which is a network that is reviled in Iran as a kind of propaganda tool against the government. And the other piece of evidence is the remarks made by Boris Johnson that she'd been in Tehran to train journalists, and obviously be acutely embarrassing for the Prime Minister if his remarks are used as evidence to put her away back in jail again.
Surely this comes then down to a moral decision for our government in the UK to intervene more strongly in this case and to do what the Americans have done and what the Australians have done and bring their citizen home.
Well, there's two things that they can do. One is to protest even more vehemently about what's happening to her. I mean, she's been granted this status of diplomatic protection, which I don't think in practice has led to very much difference in the way in which the UK treats Iran. But there's a limit to how much you can protest. Ultimately, you can't force the Iranian judiciary to do anything. But you can start to raise the stakes by saying this may have consequences for how we're willing to negotiate the nuclear deal. And the second issue is find a way to pay this debt. And I just do not believe it's beyond the wit of man, with particularly a more lenient American administration, to find a way to get this money in a humanitarian forms, in a forms of aid to Iran. It's just it just can be done. And after 5 years, I just think they really owe it, not to Iran, but they owe it to the people who are in jail, who are totally innocent of any charge and have been used as collateral in a really cruel way.
How is Gabriella?
She's okay. I mean, she's gone back to school, like many kids in the country. And of course, that's a big part of her life in terms of how her life's changed. Suddenly she's seeing her friends again. But yeah, last week, she'd really picked up on the mood of stress and distress, really, in amongst Nazanin and myself and in all the family. And so was getting quite stressed and difficult in lots of different ways. I mean, it's hard enough when you're 46, but when you're six, that's quite something to step into. I think when she looks back, she'll be pleased that she was helping to battle to get mummy home, but she'd much rather be, you know, playing Minecraft or watching telly or all the things that actually are much more fun, right?
Can you tell me how you're feeling?
One of the things I've tried to do during this is to, you know, suspend feelings at points and let's just live it one day at a time and see what's going to happen and what we need to react to and not too envisage the worst or envisage the best too closely, because we're in the middle of it still.
Richard, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Richard Ratcliffe and The Guardian's diplomatic editor, Patrick Winter. If you were affected by anything you heard in this podcast, please consider reaching out to the Samaritans on 116 123 or through their website. Do follow Patrick's reporting on this case, including a brilliant long read called The Zaghari Ratcliffe's Ordeal. This is going to be a really stressful weekend for the family. We wish them our very best. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Alex Atack and Ree Storer. Sound design was by Axel Cucoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. I hope you have a lovely weekend. We'll be back on Monday.